Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. Dan Rodericks here, Baltimore Sun columnist, and this is the Roughly Speaking podcast, episode 303 for Friday and the weekend. Today is the 29th day of September. On the show, culture commentator Sherry Parks joins me to talk about the moving goalposts of adulthood. If you think adulthood arrives later with each passing generation, some large-scale studies show your thinking to be correct. Since the late 1970s, it's taken longer for each new generation to finish school, leave home, become financially independent, marry, and have children. Millennials have even delayed getting their driver's licenses. Lawrence Steinberg, a professor of psychology at Temple University, studies adolescence and adulthood. He notes that compared with their parents' generation at the same age, today's 20-somethings are twice as likely to still be students, only half as likely to be married, and 50% more likely to be receiving financial assistance from their parents. Some have argued that the Great Recession had a lot to do with this, that we're still feeling the effects of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Many millennials, the nation's highest educated generation, experienced a tough and changing job market just as they came out of college with a staggering amount of debt. Is that why the late launch? Is that why the slower drift into adulthood? Or is something else going on with young adults? And what's an adult anyway? Sherry Parks wanted to talk about this, so she's here to do just that today. First, let's get Paula Gallagher's weekly book recommendation. This time it's a novel called Sourdough by Robin Sloan, a book Paula was all set to love, and she did, until she hit the last 40 or so pages.
Sourdough hits all my notes. This is a foodie book that blends the world of tech and food and restaurants and celebrity chefs and baking, does everything, hits all my notes. So I thought, wow, this is going to be great. And I was thoroughly enjoying the book. It's the story of Lois Clary, who is a 20-something software engineer in San Francisco. She spends her days from early morning to late night coding exhaustingly. And she's trying to get this robot arm that the company that she works for to be able to successfully crack an egg. She comes home, and the only thing she does besides sleep is to order food from this mysterious fly-by-night delivery service that slipped a flyer under her door. And she's enamored with a special spicy soup, something she's never had before, and most especially the bread, which is an amazing sourdough and comes with the soup. She'd rather have the bread over the soup. And it's run by two brothers from a country she's never heard of, this unknown ethnicity to her, but it's her obsession. And just as quickly as they come, they leave, shutting down the business, leaving her bereft. However, they give her a gift of the sourdough starter they use to make their bread. She then starts to bake bread as a hobby, but it soon overtakes her, and she decides to leave her job as a coder. And she now has passion in her work life. She realizes she can combine the tech and the foodie. And so she's going to adapt these robot arms to help her bake. So this is a satire mixed with fantasy. The book really delighted me up until about the last 40 pages. The book was just a lot of fun. It was a wry, on-target observation that skewers both the highbrow world of the curated farmer's market, ridiculous food trends, and the culture of Silicon Valley. It's peppered with very interesting food facts, poetic descriptions and read-aloud passages. But then there's that last 40 pages. And this is something that I find often happens. Authors maybe aren't sure how to wrap things up or where things are going. And so this book then takes what's a satire into ridiculousness. And the conclusion I'm going to liken to a stale piece of sourdough. It's hard to swallow. Again, this is Sourdough by Robin Sloan.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian with the Baltimore County Public Library System. You can find her at the Pikesville branch and hear her recommendations once a week on Roughly Speaking.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. the Ivy welcomes award-winning memoirist, critic, and best-selling author of The Lost, Daniel Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn's new book is An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic, a deeply moving tale of a father and son's transformative journey in reading and reliving Homer's epic masterpiece. Monday, October 16th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Noting that Sherry Parks would be on the show today, I asked listeners for their thoughts on adulthood and received several responses. Here's just a couple. George Morris said, "An adult is someone who has learned to think for themselves, but speak and act on behalf of others." Molly Grice said, "I don't think it's linear. I think there are times we are adults and times we are children or some in-between place throughout our lives. The qualities I associate with being an adult are independence and taking responsibility for one's own actions and words." Getting a finger on a 21st century definition of adulthood, or when adulthood actually occurs, is not as easy as you think. Sherry Parks, Associate Dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park, wants to tackle the subject, so here we go. The word juvenile has been used with Donald Trump a lot. He retweeted a meme of himself swinging at a golf ball and then the golf ball hitting Hillary Clinton in the back as she climbed the stairs of an airplane and fell down. So the word adulthood and being an adult comes up quite a bit in my mind when I'm thinking about Donald Trump and his behavior. Even the rhetoric that he used at the United Nations on North Korea, it sounds like something, well, it sounds like something guys say on talk radio, AM talk radio, you know, about we're going to completely destroy North Korea if they attack us in any way. But it's also juvenile. This is not a mature person. So anyway, this comes up a lot with our current president. And I'm just curious, is this why we're talking about adulthood today?
There are two aspects. I mean, certainly becoming an adult within a family is a very private thing. And one of the things that had me thinking about this is that my own daughter just graduated from college. She's 22. She's about to go abroad for graduate school. And taking on a lot of the traditional trappings of adulthood, you know, going moving away from home and worrying about, you know, visiting consulates and visas and things like that.
Is she 21?
She's 22.
22, okay.
Yeah, she turned 22 in April, so a new 22. And so what is an adult and what does it mean? And she and I were having this conversation about the prolongation of adolescence, because we know that going to college prolongs adolescence somewhat. I mean, both on the university end and the parent end. So social class has something to do with it. And childhood is this very malleable state. We know that the poorer the country, the shorter childhood is, because you're a 13-year-old soldier or a 13-year-old working in a factory, as unfortunate as we think it is, it exists because of poverty.
And but even with kids in poverty in the United States, they get indoctrinated to the serious issues of childhood, of adulthood as children, more so than kids who are protected by the higher social class helicopter parents.
Right. I mean, I have found that working class children think about money. I mean, they in ways that more affluent children don't, I mean, because they're part of that worry. And Dee Watkins has written and talking about being hearing everything, about being overexposed, that's his word, as a child. And so we know that the more affluent the family, the more affluent the society, the longer this rides. And my daughter and I have been having this conversation about graduate school, because she's more independent. She'll be in England. She'll be further away. But we're busy arranging our phones so that we can continue to talk. And we actually were talking about what this means in terms of adulthood. And as you just brought up, what also happens is in the public sphere, what an adult is changing. So adults play more. I mean, there are toys for adults in ways that we didn't talk about. The formal sphere is more playful, if we can talk about there still being a formal sphere is rapidly deteriorating. So I was thinking, what is an adult now, right now? Do we even know?
And do we have an age for it? A number?
Right. Well, you know, we used to. I mean, certainly the Bar and Bat Mitzvah suggests that, you know, puberty, it happens then. I recently saw an article that said, who are we kidding? That's not adulthood. And they're right. It's not adulthood in this society anymore.
Did our parents become adults sooner than we did? I think my father did. He was thrown into it. at the age of 14, his father died. His mother took him out of school. He had to go to work in a foundry, an iron foundry.
And how did that change not only his professional life, but his family life? I remember my parents were school teachers, so we didn't have that. But my father died when I was 7, when my brother was 14. And we remember people saying to my 14-year-old brother, "You are the man of the house now." Mm-hmm. And my mother quickly worked to say, no, he's a child. You know, don't do that to him. But the community was trying to elevate him into that space. My mother grew up on a farm, so she had a job. I mean, she at 14, she was cooking for the family.
Yeah.
And another sister was cleaning for the family.
By the time you were born, your brother were growing up. And your father died. Your mother was an educated woman. She was a teacher.
Right.
So she wanted the next generation to do a little better than that. She wanted to prolong your childhood.
She
didn't want your 14-year-old
exactly.
brother to be the man of the house, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And she was in a position, as you just said, to do that.
So what does your daughter make of this? This must be an interesting conversation to have with your daughter.
I mean, we're having this conversation because, I mean, she's going into sports psychology, so she's thinking about it psychologically. And then part of it is symbolic because she got a tattoo this week. And that's been an ongoing conversation between us. And I said, I can't tell you whether to get a tattoo or not, even though part of me was like,
please don't do that.
Right. But I can't. And so, but she got a tattoo, and it's a very loving tattoo. I mean, there's part of the message is about me. It's the number 4, which, you know, my birthday, her birthday. So it's a way of bonding us and my mother and aunts and other people in the family. So it's not kind of this really mean rebellion, but she did something that she knew that I would prefer her not to do, and it was okay. So she will be more financially independent than she's been, but there's still some dependency. And so part of it is the leave taking to go to another country and a symbolic measure of getting a tattoo, as opposed to working in a factory and being completely dependent on her own resources.
Right. So are you thinking that in general, because we're making generalities here, I guess we ought to decide whether we're talking about American children, American young adults, or just worldwide, that adulthood is coming later?
Well, in affluent societies, adulthood is coming later. So it really is tied to what the society...
To class
and what the society needs of you and demands of you.
Okay.
And we know that, for instance, when mothers went to work, that children got more household responsibilities. So it looked more like that farm family I was telling
right.
you about. But we still think of childhood as this very protected state. I mean, I've said to new parents, is one of the great things about being a parent is you can be crazy on the street with your child. You can be playful, and nobody's going to cart you away. If you were doing that by yourself, they would wonder about you.
Right.
So, and we allow children this space to do things that are, you know, outrageous from an adult point of view, to be playful, and even when they act out in ways that we don't appreciate, we don't put them in prison.
A lot of that has trickled into adulthood, what we would consider in a previous generation full adulthood.
Right.
Okay, I have a couple of things I want to share with you that from over my years of just being an observer and a writer, a columnist here at The Sun.
Mm-hmm.
One is young men in their 20s and even in their 30s, camping out in tents outside of Best Buy in order to be there when the store opens the next day so they can buy the latest version of PlayStation, mm-hmm. whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
This is while we were sending troops to Iraq and Afghanistan, and the whole thing in my head my head wanted to explode when I saw this. You know, I just find that so ridiculous.
Why
did I find it ridiculous? Because this is not what you do. This is not the kind of sacrifice, the kind of thing that you do in order to get a toy. What is essentially a toy? That's how I saw it.
So, I
found it embarrassing as a male to see other males a little younger than me. Quite a bit younger than me, actually, but in their 20s and 30s, doing that.
So for you, going into adulthood is giving up play?
Oh, no. No, a certain kind of play, I guess. I don't know. I just saw them as lining up because they wanted to get this toy. There was competition for this toy.
This gets really interesting because in your writing and in your life, fishing is very important.
It's a sport of recreation.
So how is that different than PlayStation in terms of adulthood?
I guess it's not. It's just that I don't see myself you know, spending a night in a tent outside of Best Buy so I can buy something in order to enhance my recreational pleasure. But I would be too embarrassed to do that.
But have you gone a long distance
to fish?
Yeah. So that you have to stay there and maybe camp out?
Yeah. And I see what you're trying to do, but
I'm not trying to do something. I'm trying
yes,
to.
Yes, you're trying to make a comparison
here. Well, right. But I'm not saying
the new generation has a different way of recreating, so I just need to accept that that's what they do.
No, that's not.
It was the hanging out in the tent part, Sherry. Honest to God, that's what it was for me.
I'm not trying to do something so much as I'm just trying to kind of dig into. I'm asking a question to say, what is the difference? And I wonder if what you're getting at is the difference is in how one carries oneself, that fishing has a tradition behind it, and it is manly more than it is childlike, but that the idea of taking one's toys from childhood into adulthood is somehow unseemly. Is that it?
Yeah, and I think in part it has to do with the consumerist part of it, that I need to sleep outside in a tent overnight 30-something years old, so I can buy this thing the next day. I don't know. To me, I thought we had reached the bottom there of the American male American image.
So male, and we're actually now confounding adulthood and maleness, mm-hmm. but the idea of retail as an adventure, which is something that you know lots of people do.
Yeah, more associated with women.
So is that part of it?
In part, I guess it is, yeah. Perhaps I'm being a bit chauvinist here.
Well, so, okay, let's talk about this. What is an adult male right now?
That's a good question, because if you look around for models for that, they're kind of hard to find, I think, in public life today, right now. We tend to look toward politics and sports, you know, the ones that get all the attention, to find that. And there are examples of it, but to sort of describe what adulthood is for a man or a woman, mm-hmm. which are we doing here, male or female?
Well, let's do male first, since that you're on that top.
All right, let me walk through it then a little bit, because I haven't thought about this, I haven't written it down. I would say you've reached adulthood when you are independent, principled, mature, not self-centered, aware of others. You've grown past the self-centeredness of adolescence. You're a man for others in some respects.
So all of those, I think, would be the same for women.
Yeah, absolutely.
What does mature mean? I love that I'm getting to interview you.
Mm-hmm. No, it's good. It's good back and forth here. Mature. Mature is past adolescence. Adolescence is that transitional period that can be described in certain ways based on what we know of the adolescent brain. So I think the brain matures and you can more clearly and more rationally make decisions, less emotional, capable of more reasoned thinking about things.
And that actually, when you're talking about brain development, that actually does happen for most people.
Yeah, I think it's a big deal.
So this movement from the self to other, concern for others, is a big part of your
empathy.
Definition.
Yeah, empathy. The idea of embracing empathy is, I mean, it sounds like a feminine word, but it's not.
No, it's not.
No, it's key to being a full, open, mature adult in America is having empathy for others.
So are we really bemoaning the lack of public empathy?
I am. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that's severely lacking.
When we talk about adulthood, because, I mean, I join you in that, but that's a marker of adulthood. Well, then that has ramifications for the civilization as we know it.
I have to go back to a story from 20 years ago, if you don't mind. I've written so many columns over the years. I mean, thousands, right?
Right.
I've been here a long time. But there's certain stories that stand out that I remember vividly. This one goes back 20 years to 1997. Some people listening may remember this case. It was a horrible child abuse case. Rita Fisher, a 9-year-old girl in Baltimore County, who basically starved to death from abuse. She was 47 pounds when she died.
I remember.
Yeah, it's a terrible case. She lived in a house with her sister, who was also a damaged child, an older sister, her mother, and the older sister's boyfriend, a guy named Frank, who gave an interview while he was in the Baltimore County Detention Center. And I've never forgotten this. He was asked why he didn't take some action to stop the abuse that was going on in the household, what was happening to Rita. He denied contributing to it. But when asked why he didn't put a stop to it, He said, I keep thinking maybe I could have done something more, but I'm only 21. How much could I do? And man, that stuck out to me, that quote, I'm only 21. How much could I do? Could I have really stood up to a 49-year-old woman? That was the age of the mother mm-hmm. in this case. Could a 21-year-old have told a 49-year-old woman, stop abusing this child, stop locking her up in a room, stop starving her to death? And he seemed incapable of that because he was only 21. In his mind, he was only 21. So this is where I went from that. I have to actually quote my own column here.
That's okay.
If you don't mind.
That's okay.
There's a thinking in America that goes something like this. Today's 14-year-old is yesterday's 21-year-old. And the statement usually comes up in conversations about teenage sexual promiscuity and juvenile crime. It suggests that today's teenagers have some kind of accelerated growth gland that supposedly makes them as mature and as savvy or as jaded as someone half again their age, one generation back, okay? So in the new generation, I'm saying the 14-year-old is really what the 21-year-old was a generation back. In regard to sex and violence, I agree with the statement today's 14-year-old is yesterday's 21-year-old. But the opposite statement holds a greater, more relevant truth. Today's 21-year-old is yesterday's 14-year-old. And the 21-year-old is not alone. He has plenty of company, engulfed in a sea of self-centered half-adults, drifting in an emotional and intellectual adolescence fostered by years of social dysfunction, broken families, fatherlessness, child abandonment, poverty, drug and alcohol abuse, throw in corporate downsizing, a declining community life, that we only recently stopped denying. And to this, a general uneasiness, some might call it aimlessness, in a nation still in transition from industrial to technological culture, that uneasiness or aimlessness is infectious and it infects our young mightily.
That's really interesting because I think what you helped me see as we try to pull this apart is traditionally there were trappings of adulthood. There were benefits and freedoms that came with adulthood. At the same time, there were more responsibilities. You had to think about others. You had to stop saying whatever popped into your head in terms of socialization.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been disrupted. That's what I think you were just describing, is that you get the benefits pretty early now. I mean, you get to know adult things. You get to be in adult conversations. You get to know about sex and violence. And so you get all of that early. So by the time you're 21, there's almost nothing else to get.
It's a good point.
And yet.
And the media, television, the movies,
right,
delivers a lot of this.
Culture,
right?
Delivers a lot of what used to be adult. Remember adult conversation?
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means.
Go out of the room. We're having an adult conversation. Right.
Yeah. Or that our parents definitely created these partial realities where there were just things you didn't know that they would say, well, you'll understand when you're older. And what is that at this point? It's the deeper stuff that they'll come to understand. But you could live a whole adult-ish life right now with just the superficial trappings. We know lots of adults who haven't gotten the empathy and the what you're calling maturity, who just move because they look like an adult, they walk like an adult.
Right.
And so by the time you're 21, there's not much else good to get. I mean, a mortgage,
right?
A job as opposed to play. And so why rush into that?
Okay, but are we saying that you're fully mature then in the way that we need you to be?
No. I'm just saying that now there's a facade of adulthood that has been created by their early knowledge of lots of things.
So is that a problem?
I think that is a problem. I think
facade of adulthood.
I think what you're describing is a much more intrinsic maturation, where the person comes to care about the greater society and actually act upon it. If you were on a couch, I would say maybe that's why you talked the way you did about PlayStation mm-hmm. and play.
What do you mean?
Well, because
I'll get on the couch. Go ahead.
could you recline here? Because you said, you know, these are grown men who are standing in line for a toy.
Yes.
And I thought, it's interesting because that same first shooter experience that you get with those toys is what the military uses, is exactly the same thing, to recruit and train people for the military. So that play, as it does in many things, you know, you have children playing their adult roles. And here, but here you're saying, okay, but they should be done with that. They shouldn't still be doing that at 20. They should be moving into the adult role. And the fact that they're still, I mean, the way you said toy, you know, I would invite the audience to, you know, back it up to the first time you said it, because the disdain in your voice that they're still playing with a toy.
Right.
Well,
that is kind of how I feel about it. You got to remember now, the context was Iraq, Afghanistan, and we've got all volunteer military, and people doing two and three stints, you know.
Because there's not enough people, right?
Because they didn't have enough. And I don't know, the whole tableau just sort of offended me.
So I think, I mean, that goes back to our original question, what is adulthood now? But I think deeper than that, what you're saying is we don't have enough true adults. It's not just the military that's having trouble.
I see the stuff I see on the internet, when I see the put-downs of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, when I see someone posted on my Facebook page the other day, at last we have a president with balls, and a cartoon of Donald Trump holding open his pants so TV cameras can get a good shot of his jewels, right? At last we've got a president with balls. Someone posted this on my Facebook page, some grown man in Harford County. So I responded to him. I said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself with posting this juvenile stuff on my Facebook page or anybody's Facebook page. I mean, you're free to do that. It's just you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
So in your...
This is not the way to communicate important ideas today.
So it's the demise of decorum that you're also bemoaning.
Yeah, but it looks juvenile. And we use that term juvenile because what do juveniles do? They do stuff like that, right?
So you're...
Grown men are supposed to be able to articulate, and women are supposed to be able to articulate their political views without resorting to crap like that.
So adults should be intelligent, well-spoken.
They should make an effort to be, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. If they're not capable of it, I understand. But they should try. Yeah. Am I setting the bar too high here?
Well,
what's going on?
No, I don't disagree with you, but it is a high bar. I think, and I wonder, because you sent me an article that you had written.
An essay I'm working on, yeah.
And you start talking about Andy Hardy movies as the model.
Well, I remember watching Andy Hardy movies, Mickey Rooney, and that old guy who played his dad. I think he was a judge. And they would frequently have to have a heart-to-heart talk. So his father would sit in a wing chair, and Andy Hardy, Mickey Rooney would pull up next to him, and they would have a heart-to-heart talk. And this is a way the father communicated with his son, provided a lesson, provided advice. Mature advice to a young guy who was having trouble making decisions about whether to ask Judy Garland to the dance or not, or something like that. I don't remember exactly. But to me, that became, in these old black and white movies, some sort of model of what fatherhood looked like, of adulthood, how an adult passed along his knowledge and wisdom to his son.
Well, and I brought that up because I think it pulls up two things. One, the importance of popular culture, because that was a popular culture image, and our idea of our idealized adult often comes not just from our parents, but from these popular culture images.
Yeah.
And we don't have many of those. But I also wonder,
excuse me, I used to actually compare that to real life, because my real life, my relationship with my father
was not
like that at all. It wasn't even like Ward Cleaver and the Beaver. It didn't come close to that. But even though I saw that as the ideal, because that's how it was portrayed in pop culture. Right?
And it's hard to imagine this now, but when you know, Bill Cosby was an icon,
right.
He was actually an icon of fatherhood. He actually
wrote a book called Fatherhood.
Right, yeah, because of what he was doing on the Huxtables. And I wondered when I read your essay, which I liked a lot, whether it was easier to do that at a time when we didn't know so much about the rest of what was going on in society. Because what was going on at that same time was this very, very commonly held idea that life was simple, that life was clear, that you could resolve it quickly. And in order to enforce that, it wasn't. But what was silenced was all of the noise, all of the negativity, the racism, the misogyny, the homophobia.
Bullying.
Right.
Depression, mental illness.
All of those things still went on. Yeah. It just wasn't going on in the public sphere. And I wonder if that's even possible to present that image now with, you know, without the son saying, yeah, but you know, am I objectifying her? I mean, or, which is not a bad thing, but you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that I wonder if that clarity is something we can even accomplish at this point, because we do know so much.
Because life is so complicated, because mm-hmm. we know so much. Life has always been complicated. It's just right. that we're more aware of the complications.
Because, I mean, as a mom, I would find myself saying, okay, this is what I'm going to say to you now. In 5 years, let's circle back to this and talk about this again. I was trying really hard to create this sense of clarity and safety. But then my daughter would come home having heard something from somebody else or seen something else, and I was forced into having these conversations before I was ready to have them, and actually developmentally probably before she was ready to have them. So children get raised not just by us, but by society. And society is kind of throwing things at them helter-skelter.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem. There is a movement. Actually, there's a really good one here in Baltimore Girls, where they do rites of passage. Because, you know, what young women were finding other rites of passage, which was, you know, sex or whatever, because they didn't know when they were grown. We didn't know when they were grown. And so...
So what does this movement do?
They do a rites of passage, but the young women have to show that they are ready for it. And so we don't ask our children to achieve much. Sports do it, and some sports do it better than others, to achieve something, to accomplish something, to take some risk, and so that you're ready for the world. How do we prepare children for adulthood now? You know, if you had to say, well, how do Americans prepare their children for adulthood? What would you say? I mean, there's no consistent answer.
How was it done before? How did we know when we were adults?
Oh, I mean, I think I went through without my family meaning to. I think I remember there was one, you know, being the daughter of school teachers, we were always like that middle. You weren't affluent enough to have everything, but you weren't poor enough to have programs for you. And I remember there was one summer where I was 13 and all my friends had either jobs if they were poor enough, or they were going away if they were wealthy enough. And, you know, there I was. And I wanted to have some money of my own. And so my mother gave me an adult-level job. So when for that summer, I learned how to cook. And she said it can be simple, but it's now your responsibility for this, you know, fairly smaller family to put food on the table. And that was a rite of passage. That was something that I grew into and felt better about,
right.
And was more mature.
A provider.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think especially with the scheduling that our children have. You know, like I didn't have, you know, lacrosse and soccer and ballet and we schedule our children to keep them safe and to develop them. But then, I mean, what many families are reporting is that means the child has very few chores. And so I think...
Oh, so they get off too easy because the parent's doing too much.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Probably.
Hey, back to the definition of adulthood for a moment. What you were just saying, it occurs to me that one definition of it could be an awareness and an embrace of the fact that you are a role model for the children around you, that you're not one of them, that you're actually older than them, you're actually an adult, and you need to be aware and embrace this role that you have.
Well, it's interesting. There was in your article, which you better publish soon because now we're generating interest of it, you talk about what's missing. You're quoting Robert Bly, is that there are people who no longer feel that other people are interested in their souls.
Yeah. He talks a lot about men and young men.
Right.
Older men being interested in the souls of young men.
Well, and that's
this goes for men and women.
And I think that's what you were talking about, is that turn around... And you're not just, because being a role model is actually pretty hard work, but you have to turn around and be interested in the souls of someone else, which I think gets back to your empathy.
Yes.
Statement.
That's pretty heavy. A lot of people don't want to think of themselves as playing these roles, and they avoid them, I think, maybe even with their own children.
Well, and actually one of the things that you point out is that in the apprenticeship system, people would travel miles to get to this particular person to learn from them. And we don't do that quite so much anymore.
No, that's a thing Bly talks about. It's sort of pre-industrial age,
right.
Before men went off from the home to work in a factory. They were tradesmen or farmers, right? And younger men would come and learn how to make shoes from them or how to be a blacksmith, right? Taking on an intern who works with you in your profession. That's an important role that you could play.
Well, I was going to ask you, what if someone called you up and they said, I've been reading your columns for years and I want you to take on my son. I want you to be...
Not only
show him how to be a newspaper person,
yeah,
but to be interested in his soul.
Yeah, I could take that assignment.
That's a huge responsibility.
I'd be glad to do that. In terms of my own son, have I played that role? I don't know. I don't know how to measure it. I know he's a good person.
What are you going to keep
I'm proud of him today. Huh?
What would he say?
I would hope that he'd say, yeah, I've learned a lot of things from my father about having friends, about being empathetic to other people, sympathetic to others. He learned a lot of that elsewhere, too, from the school he went to, from people around him.
You know, it's interesting.
But, you know, it's when you stand back and try to measure what your contribution as a parent has been to that kid who's going out the door, who's growing up, you have to stop and think about that for a minute.
You know, that's one thing we haven't talked about because, I mean, we're talking about empathetic fathers, and there's some evidence that with infants that there is a role that fathers often play is that they're the ones who's throwing the baby up into the air. They're the ones who are teaching the baby how to take risks. And certainly, I mean, I'm not trying to be too much about gender here, but we haven't talked about adulthood as risk-taking.
No.
As being brave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe, I mean, what constitutes real risk right now? I mean, we have the military, certainly, but that
doesn't...
Yeah,
you're welcome to join it. There's no draft. So
most people don't, right?
Most people don't, right? They play PlayStation. Instead, there's lots of military-type games on PlayStation.
Without the risk.
Back to what you're saying about being an adult willing to take a risk for yourself, for your family, for others, to sacrifice something. Yeah, I think that's all built into adulthood, isn't it?
Well, is it still?
Well, and if you compare it with the adolescent... Right? That's what I do. That's the easy. The adolescent is not the adult. Who's the adult in the room is that person over there who's older but also willing to sacrifice and not be as self-centered. Is that a fair way of measuring it?
Right, but what does that look like right now? What is that? What do you do?
You work a second job to pay for your kids to go to college so they don't have debt. Give me another way to do that besides joining the military to show that you're a brave person.
Well, aren't we saying we don't have enough we don't have enough roles and stories about adult bravery? Because I mean, I think you're right. That was
well. The one I mentioned is probably as common as any. Right, the willingness to work to support your family, especially when wages have been flat for so long.
And I certainly think that's true, and I think that constitutes both the stress for adults and the way they bravely sacrifice to do it. When's the last time you saw a really good movie about that?
That's a good question. I was in the hospital the other day looking at all those people working in the hospital with all their various jobs, and thank God they're there, you know, and they get up early to get there, and a lot of them take the bus, you know, and they maybe they think, listen, this is all I can do. This is all I can do is show my kid, you go to school, you get on the bus, you go to work, you go to school, you come home, you do your homework, you take care of your family. This is the best I can do today in terms of showing my children what adulthood is.
Well, I think I keep saying this is really interesting, but it is really interesting because when you think about if you're going to turn that into a movie or you're going to turn that into a show, because there are lots of hospital shows and lawyer shows, and often what students then say, because when they have those shows, I mean, law school applications go up and med school applications go up, and then people are surprised at how dull it is.
Yeah.
And so maybe we've become these junkies over hyperbolic depictions of adulthood and heroism, and not enough of you get up. I mean, it's like, you know, we think about Cal Ripken. Baltimore did that where,
right.
You know, he got an award
every day
for showing up every day.
Yeah.
I don't know of another figure, though.
Right.
I was really happy about Baltimore for doing that. But you can't look around and say, you know, who is this person who has shown up every day and gone to work? And that meant that there were days when he wasn't feeling so well or, you know, whatever.
It was heroic, right?
It was heroic.
Well, people do that every day, Sherry, right?
Get up
and go
don't
to work.
You? Don't you?
Well,
don't I?
Yeah, but I don't consider myself heroic for doing that. But maybe
why not?
I because it's what you do. It's what I got to do. It's built into me. But maybe that's my kids see it. My kids are both working very hard now. You know?
Well, that in a way is my point, is that when we don't celebrate the heroism of every day, we celebrate, you know, going out and vanquishing the dragon and coming back into the village.
So I bring it back to Donald Trump because it's kind of irresistible. I'm sorry to bring him up almost every time you're here now, but when I think about maturity and adulthood, I don't associate that with him. And I think that's one of the big flaws in Trump and the current presidency.
I don't want to miss that Trump is a very important example of a larger phenomenon. Of adults behaving badly, of saying things that maybe one shouldn't say in public.
Considering your role.
Right.
And if he was a host of an AM talk show like Rush Limbaugh or something, I'd have no problem with the things that he says.
But
I still have a problem with him, but it's just not the president, right?
Well, because part of being an adult is thinking about the situation and not just saying whatever thing pops into your head. There's this constriction that happens with the model of adulthood that we're talking about, at least. And when that doesn't happen, there are consequences.
All right, Sherry, this is interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sherry Parks is Associate Dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. She joins us from time to time on the show to talk about cultural and social issues in America. I have a feeling we'll be taking up this subject again. So if you want to weigh in on adulthood, please send along comments by email to me here at The Sun. The address is drodricks@baltsun.com. That's drodricks@baltsun.com. Coming up next week, we will hear from another candidate for governor of Maryland, Democrat Alec Ross. Gilbert Sandler, our favorite local storyteller, joins me at Atman's Deli for lunch and also to describe his 10 most memorable Baltimore moments. We'll meet cartoonist Lalo Alcarez. And State Delegate Mary Washington wants to talk about the problem of elderly Baltimoreans losing their homes over unpaid water bills. It's all coming up next week, so a lot to look forward to. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and have a great weekend.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.